This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it is the first day of March 2011, and today I am talking once again to Tom Secker, the host of the publisher, the writer, the force behind the Howard Beale NewsHour blog, and the man who we've talked to before on this program about false flag terrorism and 7/7 and all sorts of issues relating to those broad topics. So Tom Secker, it's great to have you back on the program. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, hi James. It's good to talk to you again.
Excellent. Well, it's good to have you here, and it's great to have you here to talk about the 7/7 once again, because there are a number of developments on that front, and for people who haven't been paying attention, they really don't know what they're missing, because there's a lot happening with the 7/7 inquest, and even some things that are not coming out of the inquest but are still related to 7/7, including a rather surprising story that came out of The Guardian recently, not perhaps surprising to those who have been following this story, but surprising that it's admitted in black and white. And of course, I'm referring to Mohammed Junaid Babar and the development surrounding that case. So perhaps we can start there, and perhaps we should start by reminding listeners who Babar is and what his role in 7/7 was, and what the latest developments are.
Okay, sure. Mohammed Junaid Babar is this Pakistani American. I think he was born in Pakistan, but moved to America when he was very young. He grew up in New York. He was a member of Al-Muhajirun, the local Al-Muhajirun in New York. He's there on 9/11. His mother worked in the World Trade Center, was there in the World Trade Center on 9/11, narrowly avoided being killed. But apparently, despite, you know, the risk to his mother's life, he was so inspired by this that he runs off to Pakistan. He supposedly joins Al-Qaeda, sets up a local Al-Qaeda training camp in Malakand in Pakistan, and for the next 3 or 4 years is traveling the world, liaising with various people who have been subsequently put on trial for various terrorist crimes. He was running this training camp. He was providing material support. He was providing the training. He is ultimately arrested in, I think, April of 2004. He returned to America. He isn't arrested straight away, but he returned to America in early 2004. He's there for a few days. He then gets picked up by the feds. He becomes almost instantaneously, at least according to the original version of this story, he becomes a witness, an informant, a supergrass. They call them the Al-Qaeda supergrass. And he then testifies in a whole series of trials in Britain and in Canada, providing, you know, very, very sort of condemning testimony against the people being prosecuted. And he was the sort of fundamental reason why most of these people ended up being prosecuted and ended up in prison. His connection to 7/7 is that at some point in 2003, two of the members of the group that were allegedly responsible for 7/7, Mohammed Sadiq Khan, the supposed ringleader, and Shehzad Tanweer, traveled to Pakistan, supposedly for terrorism training, and they go to this camp being run by Mohammed Junaid Babar. He knew them. Babar also travelled in this, throughout this period, travelled to Britain several times and met with not only Khan and Tanweer, but also members of the so-called fertilizer bomb plot conspiracy. He later testifies against these people, and you know, most of them are in prison now for a long, long time. But the thing is, Babar himself, despite being, as far as we can tell from this kind of biography, an Al-Qaeda member, an international terrorist, whatever you want to call him, the guy has served barely any time in prison at all. And he is now, as The Guardian reported recently, he's now a free man.
Yes, he is. And again, not particularly surprising to people who know the story, but again, it is surprising the court documents that were gotten out by the Guardian. Can you tell people a little bit about those documents and what they contained?
Well, I mean, okay. Babar had been, from his arrest, he'd been in prison for a couple of years after that, but most of that period he was testifying in these various trials, flying around the world, providing all sorts of useful evidence. Well, I say useful, you know what I mean. But then he was effectively released on bail for about 2.5 years. These latest court documents were his final sentencing. Approximately 4.5 years he has spent in total under some kind of supervision or in jail. And this latest hearing that took place in December, just a couple of months back, the judge basically said, we're sentencing you to your time served, and you can go free. And the particularly remarkable thing about this is that, well, two things. Firstly, the judge said, according to the sentencing guidelines in the US law, he should have served between 30 and 70 years. He was a very high category of offender. I mean, he was only a couple of notches below, you know, serial killer or something horrible like that. But yet, the judge says, because of a letter, effectively, because of a letter written by the US government to the court, they're saying, you've been so useful, you've been so helpful, we're just going to let you go. We are happy for you to go off and live your life. They even said they're not going to oblige him to do his mandatory drug testing as part of his supervised release. So he is, as you know, free to go off and get as high as he likes. They also said in this court transcript that he was cooperating before he was even arrested. So we don't know how long before he was even arrested, but this opens up the possibility that for the whole time that he was in Pakistan and travelling to Britain, travelling to America and being involved with these people, he was in fact on some kind of mission for the US Secret Services. And indeed now it's looking like he must have been, because he's never picked up at any place that he travels to, even though as soon as he went out to Pakistan in 2001, he was giving these inflammatory interviews. He was saying, you know, I'm going to kill every American I see in Afghanistan. I'm going to kill every American I see in Pakistan too. You know, you would have thought they knew about him. You would have thought they were monitoring him. You would have thought that when he flew into Britain or flew into America, they might have arrested him. But none of that happened. And now they're saying, well, he was cooperating before he was arrested. And it suggests he was cooperating the whole time. And possibly even that he was some kind of provocateur. That he was, you know, intentionally doing these things, providing this training, encouraging these people to get involved in terrorism.
Absolutely, and yes, it's particularly strange that he would be giving these interviews to people of to Americans and others, and broadcasting his intent far and wide, and making sure that he was on record doing that. It's just a very bizarre aspect of the story, unless perhaps he really was working for American or other intelligence services, as would seem to be indicated by the fact that he got off absolutely scot-free, time served, a pretty lenient sentence. I think anyone would agree. And of course, in a recent episode of my Sunday Update, I had the comment from Graham Folk, the father of David Folk, who died in the bombings, saying it was pretty much a disgusting turn of events and how it pointed towards complicity with the intelligence services. So a pretty stunning unfolding event there. And the last I heard, there were some MPs in the UK who were obviously raising a bit of a ruckus about this, but and it was going to go to, I guess, the diplomatic level, talking to the American embassy in the UK. But have you heard any further developments on that front?
No, not really. It seems to have been somewhat dampened down now. When The Guardian first published these court papers and ran with the story and gave that interview with the father of one of the victims, it did create a bit of an uproar. And quite a few people were saying there's something deeply wrong here. You know, given the usual status of terrorism suspects or people we, you know, call international terrorists, they usually get treated incredibly harshly. They get, you know, locked in a black hole somewhere. They get tortured. They get sentenced to ludicrous numbers of years in prison for doing what in reality amount to pretty minor things. And yet here you've got a guy who, he's been all over the world and he's been involved in this for years. And he's getting barely any sentence at all. There were some MPs who you know, asked a few questions about this and said, you know, this should be a diplomatic issue. But I suppose there's a million and one stories out there at the moment with all the uprisings in the Middle East and so on, and that's kind of dominated the news and dominated people's attention. And I think the Babar thing may have slipped through the cracks.
Unfortunately, I think you're right, because really this story was breaking in mid-February, and it's now the beginning of March, and there's nary a sign of any developments, and I certainly hope that it doesn't fall through the cracks, and I certainly hope that pressure can be continued to brought to bear on this issue, because it is such a huge issue, but one would imagine that at this point it is something of a done deal, and who knows whether we will be able to pry forth any further information about Babar's cooperation and why he was let off so leniently. But I guess that draws us to other developments regarding 7-7, and of course I'm talking about the July 7th inquests, which have been going on since, I believe, October. But perhaps you can fill us in on the details of the inquests and how and when they got started and what they're really attempting to do, ostensibly.
Well, as you say, the inquests formally started. They had some preliminary hearings before, but they formally started in back in October, and they are due to finish in the next week or so, at least in terms of the hearings, having witnesses up on a stand and being questioned. Now, it's in many ways remarkable that it's taken this long to hold these inquests. I mean, 7-7 happened in the middle of 2005, and it's over 5 years, it's October 2010, when the inquests start. So, and there's been a whole number of reasons why it's been delayed so long. The primary reason are a series of trials that are in some way related to 7-7. There is the trial of the supposed fertilizer bomb plotters, at which Mohammed Junaid Babar was the key witness, well, key prosecution witness. You also had two trials of three men accused of being effectively co-conspirators in 7-7. And once again, Junaid Babar was the key witness, prosecution witness in those trials. And they took place in 2007-2008. Then, eventually, we get a new report on 7-7 in 2009, I think it was. And you finally got a bit of pressure and a few people saying, well, surely you've completed all of the things that you had to do. It's about time we held these inquests. And they finally got it together. There's been a whole series of back and forth between the Home Office and MI5 and the inquests themselves as to what kind of information is going to be presented and what kind of evidence can be put up in public, and indeed whether or not it could even be put up in public. We've recently had the testimony of MI5's spokesperson, effectively, and they've been anonymous. We don't know this person's name. They're referred to only as Witness G, whatever that means. And it's a real issue that it's taken so long for this to happen, because all we're really talking about are determining the causes of death, the circumstances of death of these 52 people. And these people's families have been sat there being told all sorts of contradictory nonsense about what happened on 7-7 for 5 years. And now they've finally got the chance to actually maybe get some answers out of it. But as it's turned out, the inquests have, if anything, just posed more questions.
Indeed. Well, clarify for us, what is the scope and mandate of these inquests? How are they set up? Who is running them? And do they have things like subpoena power? Or is this more of an unofficial type of proceeding? How does this work? And under what act or bylaw is this working?
I can't remember the name of the legislation itself, but inquests are, effectively, they are official proceedings of the justice system in this country. The legislation basically says the purpose of an inquest is firstly to determine who has died, secondly to determine when and where, and ultimately to give a verdict on the precise circumstances and the cause of their deaths. You have a series of groups of the bereaved, the victims' families. You also have the counsel, the lawyers for the inquests themselves, who are effectively government lawyers, and their interest in this officially is simply to ensure that the inquests sort of proceed in a fair and reasonable manner. But as it's turned out, the lawyer, particularly the counsel for the inquests, a man by the name of Hugo Keith, QC, has been throwing up all sorts of obstacles and, you know, effectively trying to protect the government, and particularly MI5, from any kind of proper scrutiny here. It's not in any way the same as a public inquiry. An inquiry should, theoretically, have subpoena powers, have the ability to compel witnesses to answer questions and give proper statements. None of that really exists with an inquest. And as I say, there has been some back and forth between the Home Office and the inquests as to quite what they can and cannot say and can and cannot show. And, I mean, the Home Office were very much in favour of basically having nothing, really, as far as MI5 were concerned, having none of their paperwork and none of their testimony being available to the public. But the inquests managed to argue the case that basically this would be ridiculous. I mean, how can you hold an inquest into a terrorist attack and not have the role of the security services analysed in it? But nonetheless, we've still ended up with a pretty restricted scope as far as what they're looking at in terms of MI5 and all of that.
Absolutely. Well, so let's look at some of the things that they're actually talking about at this inquest, because it beggars the imagination that in this case we actually still need to determine how people died. But unbelievably enough, some things have come out from this inquest indicating that there were no post-mortems done on some of the victims or all of the victims. I'm not even sure of the details.
No internal post-mortems, without getting gruesome, actually opening up bodies and looking inside them to assess what kind of internal injuries and damage was done by these explosions. I don't think they were done on any of the victims, any of them at all, which is absurd. I mean, it's part of a whole story that you have these bombs going off, assuming we had these bombs going off, but I think that's pretty much certain by this point. And you have a whole series of people around them who die. You also have a bunch of other people who are injured. In terms of determining what happened after those bombs, those explosions went off, well, normally what you would do is perform autopsies on people who've died, assess what kind of force had impacted on them. You would also swab for residues of the explosive, and you would examine the scene itself. You would examine the damage done to the tube carriages. That all of this physical evidence should show you how powerful these explosives were, and therefore give you at least a ballpark estimate of what sort of explosives they were. And then from the residues and from whatever else you could find, you would establish their chemical composition. That is normally what should happen in any sort of explosion, any sort of bomb, terrorist attack of this kind. It appears that very little of this was actually done. As we've just said, there were no internal autopsies done on these people. So they just sort of took photos of their exterior injuries and made an assessment based on that. They've also revealed at these inquests, although we sort of knew this already, that when they did the swabs and tried to find chemical residues of these explosives, they didn't find anything. They didn't actually find any traces of TATP or any other homemade explosive that might have been used. So what did they do? Well, initially, they built computer models. And there are news reports saying that these models were first done way back in 2005. You know, a company, I can't remember its name, was contracted almost immediately after the bombings to produce computer simulations and models showing what had happened, so they could establish from these models, supposedly, you know, how the explosion took place, what damage it did, why people died. For the inquests, however, they drew up a whole new set of computer models. And in the testimony from the guy, the expert from Porton Down, the explosives laboratory, the weapons laboratory in Britain, the man said, well, we didn't have any, you know, proper chemical basis for saying this was the explosive used. So we just, you know, put in the properties of TNT and assumed that TNT was close enough and that therefore we could build our models as though it was a TNT explosion. Now, I looked it up, and high explosives of this kind have it's what they call an explosive velocity. It's effectively the velocity by which the wave of force initially moves away from the epicenter of the explosion. TNT is about 5,900 meters per second. TATP, which is what they say was used, is about 4,300 meters per second. So it's a difference of 1,600 meters a second. That's quite a lot. That's about a quarter of the entire scale that's used for determining high explosive velocities. So in these models, it must have made a vast amount of difference to the results that they produced, to the models themselves that they produced, and of course to the conclusions that they came up with from these models, to have used the properties of TNT when what they're saying was used was TATP. It's a very different sort of explosive. So how do we get this story of TATP? How do we, you know, why is it that they concluded that that's what was used when they didn't actually find any trace of it at the explosive sites? Well, because, you know, they found this bomb factory, what they call a bomb factory up in Leeds, which has these tubs with residues of what may or may not be explosive in them. I mean, we've only ever seen pictures. It's not entirely clear what process they went through to determine, you know, forensically what was going on in that bomb factory. But so then we go, okay, you found TATP in this bomb factory in Leeds, but what connects that to the explosions in London? What indeed? They didn't find any forensic evidence connecting the two. They did find some traces of another explosive called HMTD at three of the explosion sites. And they said, okay, this was probably used in the detonator. Use HMTD in the detonator, TATP in the main charge. The problem with this, they've admitted at the inquests now, the amounts of HMTD that they found were effectively coincidental. They were the sort of amounts you would expect to find in any tube carriage in the country. You know, it's just stuff that is such a tiny amount that it could have just been drifting around in the air, or it could have got smudged off something else, or it's completely innocuous. And besides which, normally in an explosion, all of the explosive in the detonator is consumed. So you wouldn't expect to find any. What you expect to find is the main charge itself, little bits of that that have flown off and unreacted and ended up stuck to something. But they never found any of that. So we're left with this very circular argument, you know, that there were explosions in London. We don't really know what caused them. So we believe they were done by these four men. We think that these four men were at this bomb factory in Leeds. We found some evidence at this bomb factory in Leeds that this is what the explosive was made of. Therefore, that must have been what caused the explosions in London. It's ridiculous.
Ridiculous, appalling, outrageous. I'm at a loss for what's the most appropriate adjective here.
Yeah. It's a mystery as to even quite how they came up with this one, let alone how they thought that the public would swallow it. But of course, the mainstream media coverage of these inquests has been woeful for the most part, and they never picked up on this. They never picked up on the fact that the very forensic basis of the case is not just shoddy, not just shows a few signs of assumption and incompetence, but basically doesn't exist. They've just made it up. They've built entire computer models of explosions on the basis of assumptions that have no basis whatsoever in the evidence. It blows my mind, really, that they thought that they could get away with this. Because this is the fundament of the entire case, of the entire story. What caused those explosions? There's lots of other issues we can get into, and some of them we will be discussing. But, you know, that's the most fundamental element of the whole thing.
That's absolutely right. And it's so, as you say, it's so ridiculous that the entire inquest can be about determining the cause of death of these people, and yet the most fundamental issue of that is not only not resolved, but just assumed, and everything is just built around that assumption. It's just phenomenal. You bring up the issue of the coverage of the 7/7 inquests, and obviously, living here in Japan, there's of course absolutely no coverage of them over here in any of the mainstream media. So I'm at something of a loss, and have only been able to follow this through through the detailed blog of for example, the J7 team at 770inquest.blogspot.com. But how about in the UK? What kind of coverage has this received? Has it received a lot of coverage? Is there any sort of societal conversation going on at this point, or is this something that's more of a specialty for some people to be following?
It has received a reasonable amount of coverage in terms of column inches and what have you, particularly in the early days of the inquests when they, for example, released some video footage of the bomb sites themselves, video footage that was filmed on the evening of 7/7 by emergency crews. And obviously that's very televisual, it's very media friendly, so it produces lots of stories, it gives the media yet another excuse to start banging on about suicide bombers and act like all of the questions have already been answered. In terms of the problems that have been raised at the inquests, they have generally focused on two issues. The first is the emergency response, i.e. how fast did fire and police and ambulance crews get down into the underground and get to the site of the bus explosion and start helping the injured and start trying to save lives. And to be fair, there is some validity in criticising that. Some of these responses do seem to have been rather slow and rather shoddy. But there's an ugly dimension to that, in that it seems to be putting all of the blame, as far as blame is being accorded, onto the emergency services themselves, not onto the people managing them, not onto the politicians who ultimately determine their budget and determine their focus and say, you need to sort this out, you need to prioritise this, but just onto the public services themselves, the actual, you know, people running the radio centres and driving the ambulances and what have you. And given that that's happening at a time when all over the Western world they are hammering away at public services and cutting their funding and bringing in these so-called austerity measures and all of this to prop up our economy, I don't really know how that's supposed to work, but there's an ugly aspect to that that bothers me. Because I know a lot of people who work in public services, and most of them are just trying to do the best job that they can, given what they've got. As to the questions of organisation and, for example, how well the radios worked on the underground, and the answer is not very well at all, they already knew this well in advance, because they've been running a whole series of exercises that involved the tube, you know, crisis management training, that kind of thing. And they knew full well police radios, fire ambulance radios don't really work on the underground. If there is something major that happens on the underground, we're not going to deal with it very well. And nothing was done. And no criticism has been accorded to the politicians, who must have known this a good 2 years in advance, for them not doing anything. So the other major issue that's been brought up in the media coverage is this one of intelligence failures, that MI5 had some kind of information on at least two of the alleged bombers well in advance of 7/7, but apparently did virtually nothing to stop them. And again, there's a bit of a problem with this narrative. For one thing, it assumes that those four guys were responsible, and therefore that MI5's job was merely to stop them. And also, all it really does is justify increased funding and increased powers for the national security state, for the security services, for MI5, for the police. And these are people who have virtually no accountability whatsoever. And there were even comments in it, if you read the transcripts of these inquests, which are very, very long, and I'm not surprised that only a few people have sort of paid a huge amount of attention to them. But if you read the transcripts, the coroner of the inquests, Lady Justice Hallett, she said, what comes out of this, what comes out of this notion of MI5 having missed the opportunity, is that they should be more aggressive, that they should be more paranoid about terrorism suspects. And when you look at the cases that MI5 have helped bring before the courts in this country in the last few years, if anything, they look overly aggressive and overly paranoid. You're talking about nearly 2,000 people arrested for, what, 150 convictions? And most of these people are being convicted for having downloaded the wrong website or something petty and meaningless like that. They're not terrorists. And yet, this whole narrative about intelligence failures forces through this idea that, no, we should be ever more vigilant and ever more paranoid and aggressive. And it's just, again, it's an ugly way of looking at the story. And so the mainstream media coverage has, aside from missing all of the important stuff about the forensics and what have you, or just not talking about it, it has helped advance these narratives that are almost entirely in keeping with the government of the day, who want to, you know, take money away from people like ambulance drivers and give more of it to the military or to the police or to MI5. And, you know, that's not a very good direction for this country to be going in. And it's not in any way really justified by what we've been told.
Indeed. Well, some very obvious parallels there with 9/11, not only with the issue of the radios malfunctioning, but also with the idea that the inquest, or the, in 9/11's case, the commission that was set up to investigate this, is really just used as a justification for larger expanded police state and further intelligence apparatus and all sorts of more crackdown on this this war on terror and the creation of war on terror hysteria. So it is really these types of inquests and things can have that effect to actually increase the overall hysteria rather than to actually bring justice to these events as one would expect. So it is unfortunate that in that respect. Well, we've gone over some of the broad strokes of this, and we've gone over some of the key issues. But other issues that you think are interesting that have so far been raised in these proceedings, or what you think will perhaps come of these proceedings once we have some sort of official verdict.
Well, I mean, the official verdict was pretty much a given from the very first day. If you go back to October, the transcripts for the first couple of days of these inquests back in October, you have this guy, Hugo Keith, effectively the government's lawyer, and this is a guy with a lot of form. He's been involved in all sorts of corruption cases and prior inquests where the police have shot someone who was completely innocent, and he was there defending the police. He defended the government against accusations of massive corruption in the whole Saudi Arabian British aerospace arms deals. He was also involved in defending the government against proceedings to do with the effective assassination of Jean-Charles de Menezes, this poor Brazilian guy who, a couple of weeks after 7/7, is mowed down by policemen on the underground. He's shot dead. So this guy, Hugo Keith, he's got a lot of form. He's not a very pleasant man. And on the very first day, I think, of the inquest, he's there saying that it would seem ridiculous to anyone in this room that we don't already know what happened on 7/7. And, you know, I'm sat there reading this thinking, well, if it's so clear what happened on 7/7, why are they holding the inquests at all? Why even bother? Is this whole thing just a great PR move, a charade? Even the BBC, on the morning of the opening day of the inquests, they had an interview with the mother of one of the victims, and the presenter on the BBC was saying, well, surely we already know everything that's happened. Surely we already know the cause of death of all these people. So, you know, what are you really hoping to get out of this? And, yeah, it seems that the conclusion will just be what we've already been told, even though a lot of the stuff that's come out in these inquests actually contradicts what we've been previously told. And let me give you a nice straightforward example of this. The CCTV footage that shows these four men travelling from going into Luton Station, getting on a train, appearing out of the train at the other end and walking through King's Cross Station. This is some of the critical evidence, although it took them 3.5 years to actually make this available to the public. This is some of the critical evidence in convincing people that these four men were responsible. But there's a major problem with it. In the original Home Office narrative, the Home Office said that the police got the CCTV, they identified these four men at King's Cross on the 12th of July, 5 days after the bombings, and that they then traced them back and they got the CCTV from Luton, and they identified the four men at Luton, and that's why we get this narrative of that's how they travelled to London. The problem is, under examination at the inquests, the witnesses told a somewhat different story. They said, No, actually, it was the day before. It was the 11th that we identified them at King's Cross, not the 12th. So, once again, the Home Office narrative is in error. Maybe a trivial error, you might think, but no. Because one of the documents that was presented at the inquests, or at least discussed by the lawyers, showed that, in fact, they had obtained the CCTV from Luton on the 10th of July, so that it obtained it the day before they had even identified these four men in London. Why? How on earth could they know to go to Luton Station and seize that CCTV if they didn't even know that these guys had got off a train in London that had come from Luton? It seems that they were, you know, already following a narrative of what had happened before they'd even got any evidence for it. And that's what the inquests have basically said. Again, not picked up by the major media, but it is picked up by the July 7th group on their 7-7 Inquests blog, which I strongly recommend people read. I mean, there's tons of good stuff on there. There are some other major issues with the evidence that they've presented. They provided diagrams of the insides of the tube carriages, supposedly at the point of the explosion. Now, I'm assuming here these diagrams were part of this whole computer simulation, this computer modeling process that was immensely flawed from the start. And one major thing leaps out, and that is at Edgware Road, where Mohammed Sadiq Khan supposedly was stood on this tube train, he takes his rucksack off, puts it on the floor, reaches inside, detonates his bomb, blows up himself, kills, I think, six other people. According to the diagram in the inquest, he wasn't stood where the explosion went off. He was sat in a seat about 15 feet away. Well, how? How could he have set off that bomb when he sat somewhere else in the train? And why is it that they've positioned him in that place in the train? Well, the reason, it turns out, is because an eyewitness said he was sat there, a man by the name of Danny Biddle, who was severely injured. He lost both his legs in this explosion. I think he lost one of his eyes as well. He was in a coma for several weeks after 7-7. He then wakes up, sees Mohammed Sadiq Khan's picture on the news in the hospital, and starts saying, "Oh, that's the man I saw on the tube train." Not the most reliable of witnesses. Okay, but maybe he did actually think he believes he saw Mohammed Sadiq Khan on that train. But the problem there is that by Danny Biddle's testimony at the inquests, he sees Khan sat down in this seat, some distance from where the explosion goes off, and he says Khan had the rucksack on his lap, and that he reached inside it and pulled some sort of string or cord to set it off. That's what Danny Biddle said. But that's not where the explosion took place. According to all official accounts, pretty much, up until this point, the explosion took place at floor level, not at the height of someone who sat down with a bomb on their lap. And they found, as far as I know, no evidence of this pulling cord detonation mechanism at the scene. So there is basically nothing supporting what Danny Biddle said. And in most ways, the official version contradicts it. So why have they got this diagram at the inquests that's based on the eyewitness testimony of Danny Biddle? He's clearly an unreliable witness. Yet he is cited in the Home Office narrative as one of the key witnesses. I mean, the whole thing's a mess. It just doesn't add up. Go on.
I don't know what to say at this point either, other than to say that it is undoubtedly a mess, and it almost beggars the imagination that they think that the British public, and ultimately the public of the world who is interested in the 7-7 bombings, would simply just swallow all of this information. I just can't understand how they're trying to put forth such a transparently ridiculous inquest that seems to be solving nothing and seems to be only adding and compounding the problems that have already existed in the official narrative.
Yeah, and a prime case of that is our old friend Richard Jones. For people who've seen my film, 7-7 Seeds of Deconstruction, the section on the bus bombing covers Richard Jones in some detail, and he's picked up in other documentaries as well. and he is the other key witness that is cited in the Home Office narrative. They say, in their list of the key evidence proving that their version of events is true, that they have these two witnesses who saw the men fiddling with their rucksacks shortly before the explosions. Now, as I just said, Danny Biddle's account is a mess. Richard Jones's account is even worse. He says he was on this number 30 bus in London, and that he got off just before the explosion happened. He says he saw a man that he claims he could identify as Haseeb Hussain on the bottom deck of this bus fiddling with his rucksack, and that this was somehow indicative of this man being the bomber and it proving the suicide bomber's story. Now, Richard Jones is widely interviewed after 7/7. He's all over the press, giving lots of different descriptions of what he saw of this man that he claims was Haseeb Hussain. The problem is, none of those descriptions match the CCTV of what Haseeb Hussain was wearing. He was dressed effectively all in blue, and, you know, Richard Jones is sat there saying, oh, he had checked trousers on. Oh, no, wait, no, he didn't. He had a different colour of trousers on. So, you know, how is this guy somehow becoming a key witness in the Home Office narrative? By the time of the inquests, they call Richard Jones for purposes that I'm not really sure about. And the lawyer for the Hugo Keith, I think it was, the lawyer for the inquests, said after Richard Jones had given his testimony, so you're not actually saying that you saw Haseeb Hussain on that bus, and no one is actually claiming that you saw Haseeb Hussain on that bus. You just saw a man you thought might have been. Well, no, the Home Office narrative had said 4 years earlier, this man is a key witness. He saw one of the bombers fiddling with his rucksack before the bomb went off. So the inquests, once again, have completely contradicted what the Home Office narrative said, and they've discredited their own witness.
Stunning and ridiculous. Laughable, really.
Yeah, it is. It is. And if it weren't so tragic, if it weren't about the fact that 56 people died, including the four alleged bombers, and we've been told a multitude of different stories about how that happened and why that happened, if it weren't for that really brutal and bloody element of all of this, and all the people who are now, you know, living their lives having had their feet blown off or having lost other parts of their bodies or been severely injured in some way, this thing would be a farce. It would be, you know, Fawlty Towers does 7/7 inquests. It's just, it's amazing that this is taking place. And it's even more amazing that the mainstream media, who all leapt on Richard Jones in the weeks after 7/7 and said, you know, this isn't the eyewitness that proves that it was suicide bombing, not a single one of them have picked up on the story that the inquests are now saying he was mistaken or he isn't actually providing any evidence of that. None of them reported it. And it's that kind of hypocrisy that, if anything, worries me even more than what the government are doing. I fully expected the government to use these inquests as a means of just trying to reinforce their desired story. I suspected that from the very beginning. I wrote an article on my blog, I think, on as soon as the inquest started, basically saying this, and lots of other people felt that way too. But what's particularly disgusting is that the mainstream media, who have been responsible for propagating and promulgating this story for so long, have completely failed in their democratic duty and in their duty as professional journalists to now say, okay, we were wrong. Some stuff that we previously published was wrong, categorically. Because it was. And they've just failed to do that. And not on one issue, not on half a dozen issues, on virtually every single issue that's come out of these inquests, the mainstream media has been absent. And it's disgusting. And they deserve all the criticism they get for it.
Indeed. Well, is it really surprising at this point? It is absolutely disheartening, but unfortunately, that's pretty much what I have come to accept, and I think a lot of my audience probably has at this point as well. And of course, we can't rely on the mainstream media to provide accurate or honest reporting on these issues, and especially to point out when they have fallen for faked or manipulated data and stories in the past, because they're not likely to trumpet their own failures, unfortunately.
And this is why things like the the J7 Inquests blog is so important, and why your show is so important, and why the other people in the independent media who are actually, you know, broaching this topic and asking these questions, why they are so important. It's not just, you know, because this information needs to be out there, but it's also because we can't trust the mainstream media to do this job for us anymore, if we ever could. And we've now reached a point, technologically and socially, whereby people are turning away from the mainstream media in huge numbers because they're realizing this. They're realizing that virtually everything that's printed in a newspaper is poorly sourced, poorly analyzed garbage. And so they actually want the truth, or if not the truth, at least some people who are going to ask the real questions, and at least some people who are going to do some proper reporting on it. And so that's why it's so important, is because people demand it. People want it. We're not in a position whereby people are so ignorant and stupid that they just don't care. Lots of people do care. And it's those people, they need this information, because it's those people who are then going to go out and tell their friends and tell their relatives. And then those people maybe are going to start putting down the mainstream newspaper and going on your website, or going on 77 Inquest's blog, or going on my blog, or any number of other places in the independent media who are actually doing their job properly, despite not getting paid for it. There's one other question, I think, that's a specific issue that's come out of these inquests that I'd like to raise at this point. And that is this guy Martin Gilbertson. Are you familiar with him? The IT expert who supposedly sent the police some information back in 2003 about Mohammed Sadiq Khan and other people.
I'm not familiar in great detail with that.
Okay. There is this bookshop in Leeds called the ICRA Bookshop that in the early days of reporting on 7/7, they identified this bookshop as one of those places whereby at least the three guys up in Leeds had frequented, they had socialized, they had got involved with other Muslims, and that this was supposedly a kind of center of the conspiracy, if you like. Martin Gilbertson was a local man. He, I think, worked freelance as a kind of IT support guru. He was called into the ICRA bookshop, and he did work for, among others, Mohammed Sadiq Khan, fixing their computers, helping them set up their computers and get the whole things working. And he said, I think 4 years ago, something like that, that he noticed they had all sorts of, if you like, inflammatory material. They had whatever, they'd downloaded jihadi websites, they'd got some of these videos of, you know, Mujahideen in Bosnia, and with voiceovers praising them for their holy war and all of this. And he said he copied this information, he copied it to, I think, onto CD, and he sent it off to West Yorkshire Police. And this was back in 2003. This is 2 years before 7/7. And he said he never heard from the police never did anything. You know, nothing came of it, nothing happened. When Martin Gilbertson was called to the inquests, and he was cross-examined by a lawyer representing West Yorkshire Police, the lawyer basically denied that the police had ever received this information, denied that there was anything in it, and explicitly accused Martin Gilbertson of being a fantasist, a fabricator, a man who was trying to get famous by saying, you know, I could have stopped 7/7 if only the police had listened to me, that kind of thing. Now, Martin Gilbertson denied this, and when he was interviewed by Channel 4 that evening, he denied it again. He said, no, everything I'm saying is true. I sent the police this information. Now, okay, this is a relatively controversial issue, and once again, we see the pattern that when Martin Gilbertson first started giving this story, the media couldn't get enough of him. But once the inquest had said, oh, no, he's a fantasist, he's a fabricator, the vast majority of the mainstream media just didn't report it. They just avoided the issue. Okay, this might be potentially an avenue of proper investigation if there was a proper investigation going on. But the problem is, it's all a bit of a sideshow, because we know from other newspaper reports that, in fact, there is this other man called Martin McDade. He is a former special boat service. That's like the SAS, but, you know, with boats. operative and a former counter-terrorist agent. And he was involved at the ICRA bookshop. And in fact, the witnesses who've been interviewed have said he was the one who was pushing this supposedly radical material, radicalizing material, onto people at the bookshop. And they say, the newspaper reports all basically say, he'd been under surveillance for years before 2003, before Martin Gilbertson even came along. Possibly that he'd been under surveillance since 1998, so 7 years before 7/7. And the problem with this, of course, is that Martin McDade is, again, someone who bears all the hallmarks of a provocateur or a double agent or an informant of some sort. He has never been arrested for any connection with 7/7 or anything else for that matter. He has never been called as a witness to say this is what was going on at the ICRA bookshop and this provides an insight into the background of Khan and Tanweer and the rest of them. He's essentially just sort of disappeared off the map, as it appears Mohammed Junaid Barbar has disappeared off the map. So we're left with a question here. Is the whole thing with Gilbertson just a distraction, a focal point for researchers, the media, truth campaigners, whatever, to provide a deliberate red herring so that people get all fixated on Gilbertson and completely ignore the Martin McDade side of this story? The other question, of course, is why is it that when we look into the background of these four men that supposedly did it, at every point that they connect to something we might term Al-Qaeda, we might term a international terrorist network, at every point they connect to that, the people they connect through all seem to be working for the security services. Because you've got, they went to Pakistan for terrorism training, but they were sent there by this guy, Mohammed Qayyum Khan, the guy known as Q, who appears to have been an MI5 informant. The camp that they went to was run by Mohammed Junaid Barbar, who was at least an FBI informant and possibly a lot more. They were involved in this supposedly radical bookshop in Leeds, but the radicalization that was going on there was being run by a guy who used to be in the Special Boat Service and is a counterterrorism operative. And that's before we get into all the questions about Omar Khayyam or Haroon Aswat. And, you know, at every set stage that they show any signs of being radical Muslims who might do something like blow themselves up on a tube carriage, at every point, they connect up to the security services. So what's going on here? Were these men manipulated into doing it? Were they, oh, I don't know, part of a sting operation that somehow went wrong? There's a lot of different possibilities. And it's only if we get a proper inquiry and actually get people from MI5 up on the stand and demand some answers out of them that we might get to the truth about it. But the point that cannot be denied anymore is that MI5 knew about these people and that they had some kind of involvement with them. What kind of involvement? Not sure. But some kind of involvement, definitely.
This issue raises a very important question overall to that goes to the very heart of the idea of the inquests, and that's that obviously it is extremely unlikely that this type of inquest will ever really ask the uncomfortable questions that might point to genuine complicity of the intelligence services in these bombings, or at least in relating to the people who supposedly carried out these bombings. So to what extent is it valuable to even take these inquests seriously? I mean, I see there is definitely something to be gained by taking a look at the information that's coming out and pointing out the discrepancies, but at some point, it really leaves one wondering how on earth do we actually move from the point that we are at now to the point where we can actually envision true justice and people actually being on the stand, being held accountable for their actions and being compelled to testify. How on earth can we move to that point from where we are now?
Well, I think what we need is as many citizens in Britain and across the world, where people are interested and motivated, we need as many as we can, firstly, examining these inquests and holding them to account, because the mainstream media isn't going to do that. It has systematically failed to do that at virtually every point. We need people to actually understand the information that has been presented, how the official story has gone from the version they were telling back in 2006 to the version that they're now telling 5 years later. And I say this because in the 7-7 truth movement, such as there is a truth movement, there's an awful lot of people who are, it seems, more interested in propagating conspiracy theories than they are in investigating. And so we need to counter that. We need to say, no, this isn't about conspiracy theories. This isn't about us coming up with an explanation of what happened. This is about examining the explanation we've been given and demanding that the evidence that is there to back this up is made available publicly. And in these inquests, they have made a bit of information and a bit of evidence public, but all it's really done is provoke more questions. So the response to that should again be to say, no, this evidence doesn't add up. And, you know, write to politicians, write to journalists, file freedom of information requests, do anything you can to force them out into the open, to make them commit to a statement. Because once they've committed to a statement, or committed to a particular version, you can then examine it, you can point out where the mistakes, where the lies, where the nonsense in it is, and say to them, no, you have told us something that is categorically untrue. Now, what are you going to do about it? Put the pressure on them, because it's their responsibility. You know, much as I respect the research work and the analysis that's being done by the July 7th Truth Campaign and some of the others in this movement, they aren't there to provide the answers. They are there to ask the questions. It's the officials that should be providing the answers. And so we need to put as much pressure on them as we possibly can. That said, there is a reasonable chance that that's just not going to work, that this is going to turn into another one of those questions like JFK, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, where 50 years later, we're still left with as many questions as we ever really had about it. It seems abundantly clear that the Warren Commission version is untrue, but we don't really know what the real truth is. And maybe that will happen with 7-7. I hope it doesn't. I really do hope it doesn't. But there is a strong chance that that's exactly what will happen. There is another possibility, and that is, once we've demonstrated that the officials who are supposed to be answering these questions and who are supposed to be explaining what happened, once we've demonstrated that they've completely failed for whatever reasons to do this properly, that opens up the possibility, I suppose, of a sort of citizens' inquiry, one that is actually independent from government and one that doesn't even draw its funding from public sources, from government. Because the problem is, however independent an inquiry might be in theory and in law, if it's someone's paying for it, whoever's paying for it is going to have a vested interest in what that inquiry finds. So we need to look into the possibility of something that's outside of the private sector and outside of the public sector, because neither of them can be trusted properly to do this. We need to look at another alternative, possibly raised, funded by donations, possibly, you know, along the charitable model, something like that, whereby a semi-permanent inquiry can be set up of motivated, capable citizens with no prejudices, with no conspiracy theories, with no preconceptions of what did or didn't happen, who can look into this properly and who can call witnesses, compel answers out of them, who can subpoena documents and other evidence, and you can actually examine this in a way that it should have been examined since day one. And you may remember in, 1990, when the whole Operation Gladio thing broke, the European Parliament passed a resolution condemning Gladio and saying there should be a Europe-wide investigation of the problem of terrorism, of the possible involvement and complicity of the security services in terrorism, and of what we can do about this to try and ensure it doesn't continue to happen and doesn't happen again. That's 20 years ago, 21 years ago. But that resolution still stands, and that provides at least some degree of a legal and historical basis for that sort of inquiry, for that sort of, you know, real examination of what's happened here. And so people should you know, take the impetus from that European Parliament resolution and go as far as they can with it. Maybe we'll never get to the truth, but I certainly think we can get a hell of a lot closer to the truth than we have already.
Well, that is definitely at the very least what we should be aiming at, and as you say, the very basis of that would be an informed, engaged, and active citizenry who is able to communicate and share ideas on this process through the internet technologies which have enabled such a fundamental shift in the way that we perceive the world and the way we come to understand information that we have to decentralize the power to control and disseminate information that has existed in our society for too long. So I can only once again wholeheartedly recommend that people go, for example, as you've pointed out, to the excellent July 7th J7 Inquests blog at 77inquests.blogspot.com, where there is a wealth of information on all of the issues that we've talked about regarding the inquest, really, and many others. And of course, I would also like to direct listeners to Howard Beale's newshour.blogspot.com, which has a wealth of commentary on a number of issues, including 7-7, and very, very detailed, very analytical essays, really, more so than blog posts, I would say, and extremely interesting. But I am somewhat disheartened to see that the last entry was from October, and nothing since then. And I'm certainly hoping that will be supplemented to in the near future.
It certainly will. This is that's simply a problem of time. The last few months, I've had time to analyze and study the 7-7 inquests, it has simply been a case of analyzing them and studying them. I've barely written much on them at all since back in October when it first started and when some of these things first became abundantly clear. Part of that reason is I am working on a book at the moment that examines the whole terrorism thing across the last 30, 40 years. The other reason is that I am hoping to, later this year, put together a follow-up documentary to Seeds of Deconstruction, which will examine where the first film looked at covert operations and the possibility of 7-7 being in some way connected to the security services. The follow-up film, I intend, will look into more so the proceedings of the justice system, some of the more horrendous cases we've had in this country where terrorist attacks have happened and completely the wrong people have ended up serving sometimes 10, 20 years in prison for it. And we'll also examine the 7-7 inquests and some of the new information that's come out from them, and also looking into some of the more peripheral issues and some of the sort of older history of terrorist attacks in London and how prepared London should have been for something like this to happen. Yes, I apologize for not having updated my blog more recently than that, but I assure you it's for good reasons. I am very much still working on all of this, and hopefully when I finish this film later in the year, we could discuss that too.
Absolutely. Well, I am looking forward to that, and I'm looking forward to all of your future work. And I think we'll wrap it up there, as much as this type of conversation can be wrapped up. So, Tom Secker, once again, thank you for sharing your wealth of information with us, and I look forward to talking with you again in the future.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.